This podcast contains adult language and stories of true crime. If you don't like laughing, crying, or being horrified at the actions of other humans, this podcast is not for you.
And welcome to the final episode of season 3 of Resolved Mysteries.
Yes, we did it.
We did it. We did it.
We did it. We're still doing it. We've almost done it.
Third time's a charm.
Third season's a charm. So this is the show where we rewatch, recap, and give you the latest updates to cases featured on the show Unsolved Mysteries. I'm Carlin.
I'm Allison.
I'm Eliza.
And this is going to be a big two-parter for the last episode.
Yeah, and we should say, for those of you listening, our patrons who are doing the live listen just right now, hey.
Hi.
Okay. And hey. We'll chat with you on Slack.
Yeah, we're probably typing to you right
now. We're probably typing to you, and we love you.
All right. For every review that we receive, we donate a dollar to a different organization. And for this month, we have chosen the National Asian Pacific American Women's Forum. Do we have who this was suggested by?
Me.
Oh, great.
I did it.
Good suggestion.
Good job.
I thought it was the least that we could do with all the terrible things that are happening.
Yes. Oh my gosh, this is great. So their mission is to build collective power with AAPI women and girls to gain full agency over their lives, their families, and their communities.
Great.
Yes, we love it. All right, and guys, we still have magnets. We're still doing our magnet giveaway. If you leave us a review, just screen grab it, send it to us via email, and we will send you a free magnet.
I want to say our email because we had someone write to us and say we didn't say it. So our email is resolvedmysteriespodcast@gmail.com. So if you want to send it over there, we will get you a magnet ASAP.
Yeah, I mean, how can we expect them to know the email when I don't even know the email?
It's very
how
true.
How can we expect them to know it when we say it at the end of every single episode?
And yet still, I don't know it.
All right, and now we are going to shout out some lovely patrons.
Thank you to Crystal P, Sherry D, Chandra C, and KTB. Ooh, KB and KTB might be related. We don't know.
Mysterious. If you would like to support us on Patreon, you would get access to ad-free episodes, 2 extra episodes a month, early access to various things, and goodies in the mail, and season finale chats.
Mm-hmm.
So great. So if you want to do that, go to patreon.com/resolvedmysteriespodcast. Okay, everybody, what are we covering in part 1 of this episode?
Okay, I have a wanted segment about a man named Rafael Camarena.
And then I have a lost love segment about Duncan Gilmore.
And in part 2, I have a wanted segment about Gregory Barker.
And then I have another lost love segment because I love a lost love. It is the story of Jerry Graves.
Double the lost loves, double the fun.
And part 2 will come out next week because, y'all, we're weekly now.
Yeah, don't forget. How could you? We just show
up
every
week
now.
It seems like everybody's pretty into it.
Oh, yeah. Nobody wants to wait 2 weeks for an episode.
No.
My podcasts that take 2 weeks, I'm like, come on.
Yeah, even if it's like the same amount of content, kind of, it's great.
Give me that podcast weekly. I need my fix.
Yeah, it's a fix. It is. We have to slowly give it to them rather than all at once. They're going to binge and overdose.
All right, ready, guys?
Okay. Here we go.
Let's do it. Season 3 finale. Woo! Woo!
All right, y'all. So we have a wanted segment, and this is the story or the man or the he's not a legend. He's a man. His name is Rafael Camarena, and we are going to just hope that Allison holds on through this recording because she just got her vaccine. And so,
yay!
And everyone should get the vaccine, but sometimes it makes you not feel great.
Yes, but it's
so
exciting.
You should still get it. And we're so excited. Our podcast is almost fully vaccinated.
Yeah. Yay! One of us is fully vaccinated, and 2 of us are halfway.
Yeah.
We're on the way, baby. All right. So, Stack opens this segment and says, quote, "For the past several years, the United States government has embarked on a highly publicized war on drugs." And we will post, if anyone's unclear about what the war on drugs has done to minority communities, we'll post a great Vox article. And also, if you haven't seen The 13th on Netflix, the documentary, please watch it. But basically, the war on drugs really destroyed our country in a lot of ways. And then this Vox article talks about how it affected especially South American countries negatively. Just it spread out and did a lot of bad things and is still doing a lot of bad things. Mm-hmm. Not great. Not great. So that's where we are. And this story takes place in Douglas, Arizona, which is a small town just across the border from Agua Prieta, Mexico. U.S. Customs Special Agent Steve Minas says the area was known as, quote, "Cocaine Alley" because of the large amounts of cocaine being brought from Agua Prieta into Douglas. Why is that funny?
Because it sounds like a nickname for Allison. For old Allison.
Old Allison. Of course, of course.
Mm-hmm. Oh, man.
And just another recommendation, speaking of cocaine, if you haven't seen Narcos, honey, get on it.
I thought you were going to recommend your favorite cocaine to us.
If you haven't, speaking of cocaine, I've got a number for you.
I got a guy. I got a guy.
I got a gal. I'm a feminist drug user, so I only get it from women. Okay. So Rafael Camarena bought a cement mixing company on the U.S. side of the border, and the business was struggling. We see his secretary, Helen Trujillo, she is just a true sweetie, and she explains that the day before payday, he would come to her and say, "I don't know what to do. I don't know how I'm going to cut checks for you and others tomorrow." But then the next day, he would come to her and say, "I've taken care of it, and here's your check." And she described him as seeming relieved when he would do that, and that happened frequently.
The anxiety of that every single time, oh my God.
Oh, yeah. For her, I know.
Well, for everybody.
Yeah. Just like, okay. Great. Thank you. He was described as a very hands-on business owner who worked hard to get contracts for his company around the community. And by all accounts, he seemed to be a nice, family-oriented man. So he built a large warehouse on his business property. And then 200 feet away on the Agua Prieta, Mexico side, which it's just so wild. When you are in border towns like that, first of all, often disparity of like looking over the fence and seeing Mexico, mm-hmm. which is quite sad. And then also just, it is so close. Like when you're in a border town, it's right there. Mm-hmm. You can see it. And so many people do or did work on both sides. Mm-hmm. So on the Mexico side, he built a large 4-bedroom ranch style home, which doesn't totally add up with him not having money for his business on the U.S. side. Then I love the voiceover. I screenshotted it. It says, "The home had all the amenities that come with success." And right as Stack says that, I'm looking at the picture of it now. It's just showing a swing set with a giant, a satellite as big as the swing set in the backyard. And those are the amenities that come with success in the late 80s. Just the biggest satellite you've ever seen. So then we see in this segment what seems to be his family or close friends playing pool at his house. And this woman, y'all, if you didn't catch how this woman is playing pool, she is just dinking that white ball all around, moving it wherever she wants, and then hitting it. And that is not how you play.
She was, like, moving it with her hand?
With the end of the stick.
Oh.
Move it. Okay, this is where I want it. Shoot it. I don't know what that white ball's called. The cue ball?
Yeah.
Yes.
The cue ball.
That's just not how you play the game. That's not how the game is played. You would think that the directors would be like, really play the game. Don't just dink the ball around.
Yeah, let's give you a quick tutorial.
It's very basic.
So U.S. Customs got a tip that Camarena was smuggling drugs into the country, and his cement company was just one block away from the U.S. Customs office. So they set up surveillance on the property, but never saw anything overly suspicious. On a hunch one day, officers followed a flatbed truck to a remote area outside Phoenix, and the truck had come was going in and out of the cement company often, but never seemed to have anything weird on it. But they just thought one day, let's follow this and see where it goes. And they performed a search warrant on the area when they got to the remote place that the truck had gone. And they found a literal ton of nearly pure cocaine with a street value of $100 million on this property, on this other property outside Phoenix.
God. Wow.
They eventually found that cocaine had been transported in a hidden compartment in the bed of the tractor trailer truck that they had followed. But they still were not sure how the drugs were getting into the country or when they were being loaded onto the truck because they never saw that happening in their surveillance. So the following day, the cement company and Camarena's home in Agua Prieta were raided, but the family had fled and no signs of any illegal paraphernalia were found right away. But at the cement company, eventually agents found and removed a large drain from the floor, and then they kind of busted out this like fake floor. And underneath, they found a 5-foot diameter shaft that went 30 feet straight down. So they climbed down the ladder to that and they find a tunnel. And the tunnel was well constructed. It had a roof, floor, and walls that were all made of concrete.
Oh my God.
They're the best tunnel builders we've had so far.
Oh, the best tunnel builders. And they filmed in the actual tunnel, which Stack says between 15 to 25 tons of cocaine were smuggled.
Oh my Jesus.
So then they walk it, and they know it's going to the Mexico side. It's like over 200 feet long, but in Camarena's home, there's no obvious signs of a tunnel. Eventually, authorities discovered that the pool table that we had seen earlier, which when that woman was dinking the cue ball around and not playing correctly, in that scene, a guy comes to the door and says something to Camarena. You don't know what he says. And he kind of tells everyone to leave the room. So they do. But that's all you see in that scene. So then authorities discovered, and then this is where we come back into that reenactment scene, discovered that the pool table and a 2-ton section of flooring that it was sitting on was on a hydraulic system that lifted up enough for a person to climb in and load drugs into the tunnel on a specially made cart.
Amazing.
Oh, amazing.
That's like a magician's trapdoor. It's usually like a hydraulic floor.
Yes. Yes. Totally. Stack says it's like something out of a James Bond movie.
Or that.
Or that. Workers would then pack the cocaine into the false bottom of the truck once it reached the U.S. side at the cement company. They would, you know, take it all the way across the tunnel. Then they made a special pulley system to pull the drugs up that 30-foot shaft, and then they'd load it into the false bottom of the truck. Minas, the U.S. Customs officer that we heard from before, calls the operation the most amazing and sophisticated he has come across in his career. And so the segment ends with them saying that authorities are still searching for Rafael Camarena, who has not been seen since 1990. And then they did not say this in the segment, but I read in a few places, and I think that it was in the original edit, that also wanted by authorities is you give your compliments to Felipe de Jesus Corona Vibera, who was the architect of the tunnel.
Oh, give your compliments to
my compliments to the tunnel maker.
Well done, sir. Well done.
But the authorities were looking for him as well. And then we see a couple of update screens, and there's not a lot more to this. Basically, it was discovered that Camarena had been arrested off the coast of Sinaloa, Mexico, on a boat that was carrying 2.8 tons of cocaine in 1995. Oh my God. He had gone 5 years in Mexico, still dealing drugs, but not coming back to the U.S. side, it didn't seem like. And then in Mexico, when they discover him in this boat, he was using the alias Mariano Zamora Villegas, and Mexican authorities did not know his true identity. So I think he was kept in prison under that name.
Okay.
So how did they discover him, I wonder?
I think he was probably, you know, with other people that were being looked at on this boat. Like, you know, it's just the whole operation being watched, kind of like when it was in the U.S., when he was in the U.S.
I was wondering how they figured out that it was...
Well, they didn't yet. So they still have... They just think, oh, this guy has cocaine. We're taking him in.
Okay.
Even though he's going under this other name, he was convicted on drug charges and sentenced to 5 years in prison. And then in March of 1999, he was profiled on America's Most Wanted. And authorities received a tip that he was in the Mexican prison under an assumed name. So they got a tip from that show airing, but Mexican authorities didn't even know who he really was.
Oh, wow.
So he thankfully was still in prison because he was only, I guess I don't want people doing cocaine, but also he doesn't seem like a violent or terrible guy. Who knows, though? He was sentenced to 5 years, and this is in 99, so he would have been released the next year, most likely.
Oh, wow.
And would have gone free. Mm-hmm. So then authorities confirmed his identity and that he was Camarena, and when he was released from the Mexican prison, he was extradited to the United States and served additional time for the drug smuggling that he had done in the 80s. And then the update tells us that he's since been released, and I tried to see if he was still around. I could not find him. Camarena is a very common name, so I couldn't find him, and I also could not. I believe that the man that made the tunnel was also taken into custody eventually.
For tunnel making.
Because I kept seeing it come up, his name, but then I watched the segment again, and he's never mentioned.
Huh.
So I don't know. I did just want to mention that this reminded me of Weeds Season 4, which if you've seen it, she gets that maternity clothing store.
Oh, right.
And she thinks... I think that's when she's like, I'm just going to do like petty stuff still, but I'm going to get my act together, kind of. And then she discovers that there's a tunnel under the store.
Right.
And it's being used as a cover. And then, of course, she's got to get involved in that. And it's right on the border of Mexico.
Oh, my gosh.
The whole time I was like, this is Weeds. they did say, they just kept saying, I wanted to mention, like... They were so amazed by this operation. And knowing what we know now about all of what was going on with drug smuggling and what still is going on, like, this isn't even that impressive to us today, I feel like. But just seeing the customs officer being like, this shows how brazen they are. I kept reading a lot of that. And it's like, yeah, you better learn what to look for. You might not be able to see it with your binoculars. They might be trying to hide it from you. So that's all. Mixed feelings, of course, about a druggy situation.
Yeah.
But everyone liked him and said he was very nice, so.
He's a nice guy.
Yeah, a sweetie. I know that we have all missed going to the movies during the pandemic.
Well, spring is here. It's finally getting warmer. And if you're like me, you're already making plans to get out of the house and do something. If that's you, then make plans to get out to theaters on May 14th with a friend or significant other to go see the movie Finding You. Finding You is an inspirational romantic drama full of heart and humor about finding the strength to be your true self. After an ill-fated audition at a prestigious New York music conservatory, violinist Finley Sinclair travels to an Irish coastal village to begin her semester studying abroad. At the B&B run by her host family, she encounters a gregarious and persistent heartthrob movie star who is there to film another installment of his medieval fantasy adventure franchise. As romance sparks between the unlikely pair, Beckett ignites a journey of discovery for Finley that transforms her heart, her music, and her outlook on life. Finding You is the perfect film if you're looking for something to watch that's fun, lighthearted, and funny. Make plans now to bring a friend, a family member, or even significant other to see Finding You, only in theaters May 14th. For more information or to find a theater showing the movie near you, visit findingyouthemovie.com.
All right, so this is a lost love segment, lost love segment. Bear with me. I feel really weird.
Oh, my gosh. It's happening. It's setting in. Those antibodies.
She's transforming.
You're gonna slowly listen to me devolve conversationally throughout this episode. Okay, so Jeannie Wagner was born in 1959 into a typical blue-collar household. Her father was a construction worker, and her mother was a secretary at a doctor's office. Jeannie was the first of three children and enjoyed a healthy, normal childhood, at least by outward appearances. Jeannie is interviewed, and she says that from a very early age, she felt very different and separated from her family. She felt like she didn't look like anybody. She thought that she may have been adopted. She says she felt it subconsciously. She felt they were a, quote, normal family, but something was different. Stack says that many families seem to have their share of untold tales, dark, disturbing secrets that are buried away and hopefully forgotten. But occasionally, these ghosts will rise once again with far-reaching consequences. Mm.
Mm. Poetic.
Dramatic and poetic.
Totally. In El Paso, Texas, Jeannie Wagner recently discovered her family's tragic secret, a secret which has led Jeannie on an emotional journey through her mother's painful past. Stack tells us that Jeannie's mother, Patsy Summers, was just 17 years old when she was married. She was shy, private, and had been raised in a strict home. Jeannie says that her mother was a very devout religious Catholic, had perfect etiquette, and was very concerned about what other people thought of her. Jeannie says that there was something in her mother that prevented her from being a whole person. She says that there were times when her mother was very happy and carefree and so much fun to be with, but then there were times when she was also very, very sad. Stack says that even as a child, Jeannie suspected that her mother was tormented by some private demon. In 1973, when Jeannie was 13, Patsy Summers attempted to take her life by cutting her wrists. Mm-hmm. And then, this is so brutal, 8 years later, Patsy entered a highway against traffic. Oh. And crashed head-on into an approaching car. Mm. Ugh, that is not the best way to do that.
Mm-mm. I cannot.
I couldn't find any articles about Patsy Summers, about the accident, and I wanted to know if the other person survived.
Yeah.
It's awful. It shows the state of mind.
Yeah, truly.
Yeah.
So she died 10 days later. So shortly after her mother's death, Jeannie's younger sister had found their mother's diary, which revealed that the man that Jeannie knew as her father was not actually her father. Jeannie says that when she read the diary, all of the things that had transpired in her family life suddenly made sense. So they show a page of the diary, and it says, "I convinced him it was his baby. He cried for a week. He told me that he would marry me, making it very clear that he did not want me, and that as soon as the baby was born, he would leave me. I had to do it. I had to please my mother. That was the most important thing in the world. I could never tell her my problems in a million years. An illicit pregnancy would be impossible for her to bear. The kids had to be perfect. There was no other way, and so we were married." Mm. So in 1958, Patsy Summers was living at home with her mother and younger brother. She was an obedient daughter who excelled in school and attended church regularly. Carol Lazenberry, Patsy's sister, says that their mother had very high standards, that they had a very Catholic upbringing. They went to parochial schools, and they went to church every Sunday. Mm. Carol says that their mother set a good example, and she expected her children to follow that example. Jeannie says that her mother had been going with a boy off and on for about a year. Her mother and her brothers and sister liked him a lot. They thought he was very responsible and polite, and he drove a nice car, which was important back then. Mm-hmm. It's definitely the reason to marry somebody.
There is mention of that twice in this episode.
Yeah, I mean, wow.
Because like, oh, it's about appearances.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Is there anything more American than marrying someone because they have a nice car? However, Jeannie and this boy, this man, whose his name is never given, had fought off and on throughout their relationship. And again, it was not even a year. Mm. So Patsy's diary detailed how she had gone to the park one day after an argument with her boyfriend. She met a young enlisted man stationed in nearby Fort Bliss. His name was Duncan. Stack says that Patsy was immediately smitten by Duncan, and soon they were seeing each other on a regular basis. Jeannie says that her mother talked to him a lot and confided in him. She thought of Duncan as a very kind person. She stated that of all of the people she had known, he was the kindest person that she had ever met. In August of 1958, Patsy Summers turned 17. Duncan threw her a surprise party, inviting a small select group of friends. By now, Patsy was living a lie, keeping her relationship with Duncan hidden from her boyfriend and her family.
Oh, gosh.
Oh, imagine that. No. They're so together that he threw her a birthday party with their friends. Oh. And she's living like this whole double life.
And he's the nicest.
He's so sweet.
Oh, my God. And I saw a picture of him when he was young. He was cute. Uh-huh. He was super cute. Patsy and Duncan continued their secret relationship throughout the summer and into the fall. In October, Patsy found out she was pregnant, and her boyfriend believed that he was the father. Jeannie says that she thinks Patsy was consumed with fear that her family would think badly of her. She believed that it was unforgivable and that she could not disappoint her mother. Mm. Stack says that Patsy was forced to make an excruciating decision. Duncan had accepted full responsibility for the pregnancy and wanted to marry her, but Patsy opted for pleasing her family.
No, girl.
Don't do it.
Because, you know, marriage is about everyone else in your life.
Exactly. And they had only been together for less than a year, and they fought all the time.
So many reasons why not.
It's not like it was an ideal relationship or anything.
No.
So Carol Lazenberry says that she didn't feel like she could stop the plans already in motion, that Patsy was set to be married to her boyfriend who was known and accepted by her family. Given the times and also given the kind of religious training they had had, Carol can see her making the choice that she made.
Yeah.
Mm. Heartbreaking.
Yeah.
What a sad situation.
It's so sad, but you can totally see it.
So sad.
Oh my God, of course. On November 11th, 1958, Patsy and her boyfriend were married. Only the two of them knew that Patsy was pregnant, and only Patsy knew who the real father was. Mm-hmm. Carol says that no one suspected a pregnancy. She says the night Patsy went into labor, she told Carol to tell mother I am sorry. And Carol realized that she was pregnant before she was married, but she didn't realize that it went any further than that. Mm-hmm. Jeannie was born 7 months after the wedding. In her diary, Patsy described praying for a child with blue eyes like her husband's, and she received her wish. Mm. Jeannie Wagner says that her firm belief is that secrets cause people harm and cause a lot of suffering, and that's why the truth has to come out, and she has to know who Duncan is. Mm. Stack tells us the night Jeannie's story aired, a woman named Suzanne Gilmore was watching.
Oh, this is the best.
It's so good. So Suzanne Gilmore is watching UM at home in Lake Wylie, South Carolina, and Suzanne's husband, Duncan, was asleep.
It's too nice.
She's too nice, too.
Yes. I know. I love them so much. So then Suzanne is interviewed, and she says that Patsy had written in her diary that Duncan was the sweetest, kindest man she had ever met. And Suzanne said, quote, "That's my Duncan." I was, like, dying through this whole segment.
Yes, the best. God.
It's just so good of her. Like, many women could have easily been enraged by learning this.
Which is so stupid, but because of course your husband had sex with other people before you got married, but yes.
No.
Yeah, totally. She's so nice.
Yeah, she's a sweetheart. So then they interviewed Duncan, and Duncan Gilmore says the next thing he knew, his wife woke him up and asked him if he was ever stationed in El Paso, Texas. And were you there in 1958? And he said, yeah. And then she said, did you ever know a Patsy Summers? And he said, yeah. And then Suzanne asked, did you sleep with her?
Oh my God.
Can you imagine being Duncan? You're a little sleepy head. You just wake up.
What are you talking about?
Yes.
He's probably like, what is happening right now? Suzanne says, he said, what, what? And he just kind of came awake.
Oh.
And Duncan said, well, yeah. And Suzanne said, congratulations. You have a daughter and she's looking for you.
Oh.
Oh.
So and it's cute. Like she knew he would probably be really excited. She wasn't like
she knew that about him. To yes.
Yeah, yes. Totally. Yes. Yes. And then Duncan says, quote, I just knew that she was my daughter and that we had to be together and I had to see her and I had to respond.
It's too nice.
They are such dolls. So Stack says 9 days and dozens of phone calls later, Duncan Gilmore and his wife Suzanne arrived in Houston, Texas. On May 3rd, 1992, Duncan and Jeannie met for the first time. And they show them meeting, and she opens the door, and they just have this huge hug right off the bat. It is just the sweetest thing, and he's saying hi, and she's crying, and oh my God. So Jeannie says that when she hugged her dad, it was a combination of being really, really happy, but also there was a little sadness there that so many years have gone by, and that they've missed out on each other's lives.
Especially, like, knowing that he wanted to know her, too. Like,
that's such totally.
You have to mourn for that time lost.
Absolutely.
He is literally the nicest person we've ever seen on UM.
Yes.
Certainly in a very long time, because I can't remember anybody nicer than this in a while.
Yes.
So Duncan also got to meet his only grandchildren, Joshua and Justin, and they're showing video of them playing catch in the front yard. And then Jeannie says, she can't think of a better grandpa for them to have. She says she never could have hoped and prayed for this to turn out as well as it has. She says that Duncan has turned out to be everything that she thought he was going to be. And she says that tomorrow and the day after, she'll now have a dad who loves her and wants to be a part of her life.
Mm-hmm.
So her relationship with her father, who she thought was her father, could not have been that great.
Right.
If she's not even worried or talking about this other person's other man.
I mean, she's kind of explicitly saying that her real dad isn't that.
Yeah, kind of, right? So the update here is very succinct. There's a lot of video of them walking together and being happy. But I did find a newspaper article that expands on the story a bit, so I'm just going to read from that.
Okay.
Jeannie Wagner is interviewed by this newspaper. I don't know it off the top of my head, but it'll be in the episode notes. Jeannie Wagner says, quote, I'm exhausted but really happy. I couldn't have hoped to have found a nicer man to be my dad. He's wonderful and his wife is wonderful. So within 45 minutes of the broadcast, Jeannie Wagner, who was 31 at the time, received a call from the Unsolved Mysteries Telecenter. In that conversation, a supervisor told her that he, quote, felt very good about a caller who thinks he's your dad and gave her a telephone number to call.
Wow.
Although Jeannie Wagner's greatest wish was to find her dad, she was unable to make the call at the moment and received a second request to make the call before she was able to make it. When her father's wife answered, she told her, I don't want to put you on the defensive, but I want to make sure that this is the right person, Jeannie said.
Mm-hmm. Does the call center, I wonder, have specific questions that they are given to ask to vet these people that call in and say, I'm this person's dad before passing the number on? It seems like they did.
Yeah, I would imagine that they did because you don't want to upset people by sending all of these people in their direction.
Right.
So I'm sure that I'm sure they said, what's your name? And I'm sure Duncan immediately was like, I'm the person. I was stationed here. I knew Patsy Summers. She was pregnant then. This is what happened. You know, so I'm sure he just offered enough information that they knew it had to be him.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So after speaking to her husband, the woman asked Jeannie Wagner if her mother had ever worked as an instructor at an Arthur Murray dance studio in El Paso.
Whoa.
Yeah. Jeannie says, I broke down then because I knew that it had to be him.
Yes.
She said that information was never made public. So at that point, Jeannie said that she told Suzanne Gilmore, I have to call you back because I have to get myself together.
Oh.
When she returned the call, her stepmother told her, your dad's crying, I'm crying, and he wants to talk to you.
Oh.
After a somewhat awkward beginning, quote, "We just started talking about everything," Jeannie said. "I had always assumed that he was aware of the other relationship my mother had with this man, but he wasn't. He was devastated when she told him that she was pregnant and had to marry the boy that she had been dating, the one that her parents expected her to marry. So I guess Duncan thought it was the other guy's kid."
Oh, wow.
Oh my God. Yeah, that makes even more sense because
right?
I feel like he just would have wanted to.
But you'd wonder if he always kind of wondered, though.
Yeah. So the article goes on to say that Duncan Gilmore told Jeannie that he had made another attempt to see her mother 2 weeks later, but that she told him to never contact her again.
Gosh, that's so sad.
That Imagine. Is so sad.
Mm-hmm.
And you know that broke her own heart to have to say that, but she's got all this religious shame. It's awful.
I know. It's terrible. Jeannie says, "My dad," meaning Duncan, "was very saddened to find out how my mother had suffered so. And I found out that I have a brother and two sisters. I forgot to ask where they live. I was worried about their reaction, but he said, quote, they will be fine. Don't worry about them."
Aww.
And then the article says, "The two plan to exchange photographs immediately. Jeannie Wagner says that she requested a picture of you when you met my mom and asked to see what he looked like then."
Aww.
And then it wraps up with Jeannie says that her mother is now at peace. Quote, "Her sister called me today and said, your mother's turning cartwheels in heaven."
Aww.
Yeah. That's pretty much all I have. I found Jeannie. She is a genetic genealogist and truly looks as though she has not aged in 30 years.
That's cool that she's in genealogy.
Yeah. Mm-hmm,
yeah. And then Suzanne Gilmore is 77 and lives in Florida. She is a piano teacher and she has a YouTube channel with her students. And it's just about the sweetest thing ever.
Cute.
And then, sadly, Duncan passed away at the age of 76 in 1998.
Aww.
So Jeannie was right when she said that she was sad about the last time because she really only got 6 years with him.
Oh,
I know. I was so sad to hear that he had passed away, especially Suzanne is still alive and, like, he would be just, you know, it's the saddest.
Yeah.
But at least they got to meet.
Yeah.
At least they had those 6 years. 6 years is better than no years. And that's it. That is the sweetest, sweetest lost love I think I've ever done.
Oh, my gosh. I love it.
Duncan Gilmore.
And if it weren't for UM, they may have never known each other.
I know. Yep. Thank you, Stack. So part one is concluded.
Well communicated.
This is the conclusion, but we will be back next week for part two of the season finale of season three. And what are we covering?
I have the wanted segment of Gregory Barker.
And then I have another lost love segment, and it is the story of Jerry Graves.
Okay. So go to patreon.com/resolvemysteriespodcast if you're interested in supporting the show. Subscribe at the $5 a month level or higher. We still have those fun other tiers to check out, too. And you'll get ad-free episodes, 2 extra episodes a month, and other goodies in the mail. Please don't forget to rate and review. It really helps. We appreciate everyone who has done that so far.
Oh,
it's so fun to read through all those 5 stars and bury those 1 stars.
You guys are great at following instructions.
It's truly so great at following instructions. I'm going to read a couple of reviews next week. So keep doing that. It really helps the show out and we can't tell you how much we appreciate it. To see photos we reference in the episode, like Sweetie Duncan and can't even remember what my segment was. Oh yeah, the
cocaine.
You can go to Instagram and follow us there at Resolve Mysteries Podcast or on Facebook and Twitter at Resolve the Pod. You can contact us at resolvemysteriespodcast.com. You can email us at resolvedmysteriespodcast@gmail.com or you can send us mail we can hold in our grubbly debbies at P.O. Box 14005, Portland, Oregon 97293. And when you're sending us that stuff, don't forget that we still are looking for and always need stories for our listener short stack episodes where you send us things and we read them on the show. You can send us your favorite Unsolved Mysteries segment that you can remember from childhood or from adulthood, for those of you who were adults in the 80s and 90s. There are some, and we love them.
Yes, we do. We love our boomers.
nostalgia you have around the show, a cold case that you are interested in, and we just love to hear from you, and we'd love to keep making those, so keep sending them. And last but not least, like I said, subscribe, leave a 5-star review, tell a friend. Let's keep growing the show, and don't forget that for every review that we receive, we donate $1, and this month's organization is National Asian Pacific American Women's Forum. And if you leave us a review, you'll get a magnet while we still have them, so go do it.
They're so cute.
All right. Happy birthday? Happy birthday.
Happy birthday, everyone.
Well, everyone does have a birthday. Yeah.
And it's today. Has a birthday.
Happy birthday to the season 3 finale.
Okay, bye.
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 And our email is resolve must blah, blah,
blah. Resolve mustard.
And our oh, I love mustard. We should make
me
that.
Me too, honey.
That no, should be I a do. Patreon series. Just trying different mustards.
Just us talking about the condiments mustards. We love.
Oh, resolve mayonnaise, resolve mustard. Resolve oh my gosh, mayonnaise. There's so many options.
Oh, I'm
actually
I'm in.
I have to say, real quick. If anyone likes mayonnaise, I have gotten the mayonnaise for you, honey.
Is it the okay. Japanese one?
Yes.
Yes, honey. Cupie, cupie, cupie.
Cupie. It is so good. The bottle is so weird and floppy, but it is the best mayonnaise, and it makes the best spicy mayo for your sushi. Ooh, it's so
honey,
good.
I bet it
honey.
Does.
Honey. Cupie mayo.
Oh, I'm ordering some
but
right
you
after
have
this.
To get the real one. You cannot get, there's like one made in America that's not the real one.
Not the same.
Okay. That's resolved mayonnaise corner. back to it. Okay. Like I was saying,